Hello, everyone out there in webinar land. Today, we're going to do webinar number 7 out of 11. I'm calling it Net Profit Analytics Plays number 4. So this actually is part of a little subset of 4 webinars, just going into specific sort of cookbook how-to recipe plays that you can do if you have Net Profit Analytics at the SKU line item level. So let's get on with the show. In this particular webinar, I've got basically sort of 3 plays. I'm calling them 11 A, B, and C, and we'll just get right into it. By the way, here's my email address, bruce@merrifield.com. So if you want a copy of this set, number 7 webinar slides, just email me. Or, you know, if you're thinking of doing your own customized version, I'm happy to send you the slide deck of all 11 webinars. I also put my full official name here, D. Bruce Merrifield Jr., because if you search for me on LinkedIn, I'm happy to connect with anybody. And I put a stream of sort of curated commentary kind of posts there, in addition to the blogs and articles I write. Okay, so here is sort of a big picture of winners, losers, and friction percent. So what we see here is a typical customer whale curve. So on the x-axis, we start over here with the most profitable net profitable customer. We take the net profit from that number one account, and we stack it up the vertical axis. We take the number two and stack it on top. So you can see that a very small percent, you know, like in this case, maybe 5% is giving you a huge percent. Well, it's giving you, you know, 150% or more of your profits, because you have to have super profitable customers to pay for. When it starts to slope down, these are all customers down here who are losing you $5, $10, $15, $30, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the tail of the whale, there's a handful of actually very large accounts who give you good sales and good margin dollars, and they may even give you a good margin percent, but they have intergalactically huge small dollar picks and or orders and returns, which adds up to a big loss. So that's fine. That's sort of a one lens at looking at customer profitability. But then you can break it down other ways. So for example, the Waypoint Universe, there's a report that gives you this kind of little box score at the bottom. And you'll notice that these 3 colored boxes, green, yellow, red, those are 16% of the customers that generate 88% of the margin dollars, not net profit dollars, margin dollars. You'll notice that 22% of the big accounts are profit drain accounts. So in other words, if I go down here, you know, you got 1,200 total accounts. These total 85, 69, 49 add up to 16% of this number, but 44 losers, big losers, that'd be the tail of the whale, add up to 1/5 of the big accounts. So, you know, you have just have financial numbers, you get excited about big sales and big margin dollars, not realizing that some of these guys, yellows are roughly break even after sales compensation, and then the pink ones are just big losers. And so you can see in the big losers that this would be the tail of the whale. 3.6 of all customers generate, you know, 12%, 13% of revenue and margin dollars, but they're 22% of the expenses, so you have a big loss. And over here, you can see invoices. They're generating 20.2% of the invoices, of which 77% of the invoices are losing invoices. So they may give you a profitable order. It's just that statistically, all the orders they give you on average, you know, 77% are losers. So then you say, I'm not going to get into the weeds of it, but basically this last efficiency percent is an indicator of friction that exists within the account. In other words, these are potential activities at the line item order level coming out of a given department or a given location or whatever, where, you know, the customer unwittingly is kind of a sort of devolved or regressed to, oh, we're out of it, order it now, and we'll sit around and wait for it. And so they're giving you, you know, lots of little emergency orders. That would be one scenario, or other dysfunctional things. So the point is that all customers have friction, of which some of it is really unnecessary. It creates losing, you know, sort of buying procurement downtime activity for them and losing service fulfillment activity for the distributor. And by going out and zeroing in on the site, you can clean it up and both people have a win-win savings. And if you go to any buyer, purchasing 101 says, you know, ideally, we don't want to have expediting. Some buyers say, well, that's my job. You know, if you get rid of all, if you consolidate my paperwork and you consolidate all my expediting, well, they're going to, well, you know, what am I going to do? Well, you know, you have an opportunity cost. And in theory, you know, your boss should be giving you a lot of things they want you to do, proactive, objective, innovative, let's move forward, make stuff happen kind of things. But you can't get to it because you're so busy. So we want to consolidate unnecessary losing busyness so we can put our time and energy into proactive, you know, better benefit activities. So they do understand in theory, as long as they've got job security, that they want less expediting and less downtime because whatever they're ordering is somebody needs to use it to put it into something, you know, it's an OEM ingredient or it's an MRO thing, they need it to do their job. So then you have less productivity or quality of whatever you're trying to do because you don't have what you need when you need it, where you need it. On the flip side of that, you would like to say, well, how can we have more uptime? And that creates more value and productivity for the customer's customer, because indirectly, that's what it's all about. Also, they do understand that, you know, if I issue a zillion purchase orders a year and I rank them by the size of the purchase order, what's the spend dollars in this thing, and I you know, did a cumulative counting column, you know, the bottom 20% of the purchase orders account for maybe 1% of the spend. And when you follow all the paperwork and the cost and the overhead of people, you know, fooling around with purchasing, you realize, gee, that's a lot of purchasing activity costs for no spend. And then, of course, this doesn't even see the expediting and the downtime. It just is looking at a paperwork kind of cost thing. So basically, we can go out with this kind of data at the line item level statistically and help customers tune up their sort of replenishment buying process. It's a little bit like if you, you know, went to some big old mansion was built in 1920 in the roaring 20s on Lake Erie in Buffalo, New York, and their heating bill is $8,000 a month or something during the winter. And, you know, you go to the door and there's a little team of people saying, hey, we have all these little detections to whip around your house and find, you know, places where there's you can actually see daylight from outside. And we're going to, you know, find all these little leaks, et cetera. We're going to plug them all up and we're going to reduce your energy bill by 35%, and we're not going to charge you for it. What do you say? Most people would say, yeah, well, that would be swell. Terrific. You know, less carbon imprint, et cetera. So that's what we're sort of looking at here. Next slide here. Now, remember, when we're looking at big accounts and we're trying to identify unnecessary friction that we're going to remove for a win-win, the fact that a customer is very profitable or unprofitable is still a symptom. We don't know what the root causes of why the customer, you know, buys a lot, buys 100% from us, buys in large average order size as opposed to, you know, we're out of it, ship it to me right away, you know, internal discipline. But with the different lenses that you have within Waypoint, 15 different ways to sort of do a deep dive and look at the customer from all these different angles, you can zero in on the root causes, or you can say, oh, you know what's going on, and you can make a very educated guess about what's going on. But typically, you know, you do have to kind of go out and follow your product and paperwork through the place, and you have to go into the actual department and say, dude, why did you buy the equivalent of 415 AA batteries last year, one at a time? You know, why don't you buy like a case, you know, and that'll be a lot of consolidation costs and so forth. So, you know, it helps to have obviously customer knowledge and then maybe to do a site walk through and chat with some people to figure out what the final root cause problem is and then what would be the simple little fixed solution. And when it comes to little simple fixed solutions, these problems exist in all channels of physical product distribution flow. So one of the benefits I have is I worked on 150 different channels, and I've seen a lot of solutions for these kinds of problems. So I say, oh, you know, you got to steal this idea from the hardware store, you know, solution problem or whatever. So you can find kind of analogs in other channels, and you say, ooh, how do we take this and adapt it, adopt it to our particular spot? Also, you can learn from the customers. In other words, if I go back to that whale curve and I go to the absolute very best customers that have the very least amount of friction, how do they do that? What are their best practices, and how can I take those best practices and apply them to a customer who's very much like them? They're the same sort of category, niche segment of customer. They're just, you know, they've got the bad habits. And I suppose if you sort of plotted, you know, customers and their, you know, friction percent, you might get sort of a bell-shaped curve, and, you know, 5-10% of your customers are very, you know, disciplined, you know, replenishment buying, you know, creatures. And 5-10% just have devolved to being kind of slobs. I mean, it's like if you went through a upscale neighborhood with a three-car, everybody had a three-car garage, and, you know, everybody was on vacation, but their garage doors are open, and you sort of looked at how neat and organized the garages were. They're not all going to be equally the same. Some people are going to be eat off the floor, and everything's organized with, you know, barcodes on it. And there are places there's no place to park the car. So what we want to do is learn from the bright spot, friendly customers, best practices, and then over time, we're going to actually, you know, because we can do one customer at a time, we can start to move towards the big profit drain sort of bullies, you know, incorrigibles that, you know, don't want to change, et cetera, you know, very belligerent. In many cases, what you're going to do is to invent and install and maintain some sort of custom spice rack. And when I say spice racks, you don't go to the store to, you know, prepare, you know, buy stuff for, you know, the next 4 or 5 meals at your house, and you have different recipes. You say, oh, and for this recipe, I need 3 dashes of this particular spice sauce, and I need 2 pinches of this particular, you know, spice. The store won't sell them to you. They, you know, they'd go broke, you'd go broke, et cetera, enormous amount of activity. So when it comes to very small, frequently used or randomly used things, you know, it pays to actually have it's a positive trade-off to actually have a rack where you have the spices, you make an investment in that inventory, and yeah, you've tied money up and you've tied space up, and you've and some of it may rot before you use it, but you always have it when you need it. So uptime productivity, 1, and then 2, not an intergalactic huge replenishment activity for pinches of time. You just buy a container of the particular spice. So you're going to, you know, come up with that kind of a solution for these the customers that have an opportunity. The rep can at any time sort of judo pivot on any price inquiry. So if somebody says, is that the best price you can give me? Of course not. We have customers who don't even buy as much as you do, and they have better prices, but we have a more efficient, effective win-win replenishment system. So if we can work together, so we can, you know, basically in general, build average line item picks and order size, then our cost to serve as a percent of sales drops. And out of that savings, we can share it at a lower price. Plus, we can lower some or all the other elements of total procurement costs, give you more uptime, productivity, and make you look like a hero. And if you're interested in that scenario, then would you like my audit team to come out and make you a pitch and so forth? So, that's the opportunity. Now, this slide just illustrates the different 15 lenses in the waypoint particular universe. If you have a big loser, this is a disguised name, Benitz Brothers, you can right click and you get 11 different lenses here. And then under a general customer tab, you can check all customers, including these guys, for credits below cost, you know, credits as a percent of total invoices, you know, credits return costs, ranking by delivery costs, special stock customers, back orders, and so forth. Now, here's a report where, you know, it just shows for any given chosen period of time, I just took a year's time for this particular customer, the total number of invoices, picks, GP dollars, et cetera. And in this report, what I did was I ranked it, because you can just click it, a little arrow pops, you can rank it by pick. So the account that had the most picks at 4,200, that's just a lot of activity. But then if you go GP dollars per tick, cost per serve dollar, cost per, so $15 per pick and GP, the cost per pick's $4, so they're making money on every single pick on average times a lot of picks. But if you then go over to the second number two column and you're looking for people that you're losing on average on a pick. So here's a guy where we're losing $4.62 every time we have a pick 2,400 times. You can see they're upside down as far as the GP dollars and the cost to serve dollars. So then you can do a deep dive with that account and find out what's going on. Some general comments. You'll find often that multi-location clients, sometimes there's a buying group and it's a whole confederation of little retailers or restaurants or something, and the confederation goes to a distributor and says, hey, would you like to bid on this monster sales volume deal and maybe a pretty good margin dollars, a pretty good margin percent. But then you've got a zillion little guys all buying small quantities. And of course, you're billing the confederation, you know, but you're still actually winding up with overall a losing situation. But in the Waypoint universe, you can actually zero in on the specific location or out of restaurant chains, specific stores in that chain or school bids. You know, some schools say, in fact, I saw one distributor where, you know, their big most profitable customer was actually a school bid, where, you know, it was like a magnitude of a couple hundred thousand dollars, but they were delivering all the stuff to a central facility, and then internally out of that central facility delivering all of the stuff to the 50 different schools in the system. Whereas another one, same volume, same sort of margin dollars, but they were delivering, you know, just-in-time deliveries to 50 different little locations and getting crushed, obviously, on delivery costs and so forth. So you can zero in on even specific locations that have, you know, particular problems. And then once you do that, we can figure out what the statistically crazy activity is and then figure out how to, you know, store some of that on site. And since we're selling, you know, instead of selling it to you 82 times a year, how about we sold to you 4 times a year? So we're forward selling, storing stuff on site in a disciplined replenishment kind of, you know, container storage system, and we achieve a positive trade-off where, yes, we're loading you up with more inventory and spices in your kitchen, but if you look at all the other, you know, hidden costs, it's a huge favorable trade-off. So let's jump to a specific play here. So here is, you know, Benitz Brothers. This is a disguise from actually a moving company. And you can see that for a year, they had 129 invoices, total revenue, GP dollars. Look at that GP percent, margin percent, 38%. That's really great, but they're losing a lot of money. Why? Five whys. And we sort of dig deep, and we can go, for example, and we can look at their SKUs. And they bought 43 stock keeping units. And if we rank the SKUs by the profitability of the SKU, so this is just the bottom 12 out of the 43. At the top, they may have a couple of SKUs that actually, on average, you know, because of, you know, how they bought it, so where they made a little bit of money. But at the bottom, the only way you can really have a big losing SKU is to buy it a lot of times, 63 times, to have a low gross profit dollar in the ticket, and then the cost to serve has got to be upside down. And in this case, as we dug deeper, what we found is that these guys were basically, they would go to a house and say, okay, you want to move. And it looks like this is the amount of packaging materials, these kinds of boxes and wardrobes and wardrobe bars and tape, et cetera, stuffing paper, that you need. And in this dysfunctional moving company, they basically decided to always overorder, have the stuff delivered, you know, by the distributor to the house. And then what they didn't use, they wanted that to return that to the distributor, even though they were going to use the same stuff at the next moving site. Now, they had movers that they made money on, but those movers said, you know, we buy the same stuff over and over. Can we just buy a ton of it and have it at our warehouse, and we'll have it on our truck? And if we'll always have more on our truck. So if we need more, we'll have it, and we'll just bill them for whatever we use, and then we'll return it back to our pile at the distribution center. So basically, by going out to the customer saying, gee, you know, you bought this 63 times last year and returned, you know, return stuff 63, you know, the overage 63 times, whatever. You know, let's look at all the frictional costs that this is creating, not just for you, but for us. And how can we basically give you a program where you store it at your place as the number one best mover best practices has, you know, informed this particular distributor, and we can solve the problem for a win-win. Here's a second scenario. This time it's a truck repair shop, and they're buying stuff from a heavy-duty truck parts distributor. In this particular case, the truck repair shop bought over 800 stock keeping units, different stock keeping units over a 12-month period of time. I took the bottom eight off the ranking report, where you can see, okay, they bought this part 102 times, this one 63 times, 37, 33. And you know, we don't know that besides the GP dollars per pick. So, for example, that's a lot of GP dollars per pick on 10 picks. And then it's a very low margin. We can zero in on that. And that may be a different kind of problem, and it isn't part of the spice rack solution. But we're looking for the spice rack solution. We're looking for very high SK, you know, picks, very low margin dollars. And to a certain degree, it reflects that repair shop's client base. So if I have 10 trucks and I use this particular repair shop to take care of those trucks, and they're all a certain model, size, you know, whatever, and they all have sort of recurring kinds of problems, that's going to reflect perhaps in the fingerprints, the DNA, the small little detail activity of this particular shop. So what we're going to do is say, all right, we're going to go up, you know, up the ladder here, and because they're more above here, where again it would be high picks, low margin dollars. It would reflect some repetitive activity you're doing, probably for some core customer, and we're going to give you a customized spice rack for those items. That's going to consolidate your buying activity, receiving, putting away, then going and getting it. When you have a lot of picks, it would suggest, oh, you don't have it at hand, so you can't bill labor per hour. If somebody's sucking a thumb while there's a truck that's got downtime costs, which is very expensive for your customer. So this will improve your labor productivity. It'll improve your service response time and reduce the downtime lapses for your core customers. They're like, wow, that's fantastic. Gee, what else can we do or buy from you? So, you know, every time you go out and you offer one of these win-win solutions, make sure you also, you know, look for more things you can put on this new improved invented system, this co-created replenishment process that you've got going with the customer. And then another variation on a theme. We were looking at one Waypoint client, and I said, well, let's look at your biggest losing supplier. There's a supplier they're doing about $400,000 a year with, and the average margin percent was intergalactically huge, 43%. Oh my gosh, that's such a problem. No, you'll find that the vendors that are large and the vendors that average a high margin percent are vendors that specialize in selling lots of little bits and pieces. And so if they get picked and bought, you know, in little quantities, the activity cost of fulfilling that actually exceeds the margin dollars. So then, you know, so on an aggregate basis, we knew that this was the biggest loser. And I said, well, let's look at the biggest losing stock keeping units. So they bought 100 different SKUs from this particular supplier, let's just say. So we went to look at the biggest losing SKU. Then you can right click on the biggest losing SKU and you can see all the customers that are buying the hell out of that SKU. And when we did that, that's when there was an audible gasp. It was a virtual session, like the light bulb went on for over the customer's head. They said, oh my gosh, these are all customers where we deliver just-in-time deliveries. Typically what we do is they have a manufacturing cell and they need like anywhere from 15 to 30 different SKUs in a kit, if you will, and we deliver these things twice a week, 100 times a year. Now, you know, of the 15 to 30 items, a handful of them are like $100, $200, $300. So they're expensive, you know, things, and you wouldn't want to have a lot of that lying around as far as inventory investment or space they take up. But then there's some of these things are the equivalent of paper clips. And so this is a paper clip. This vendor makes these special little clips, these little plastic, electrostatic, whatever clips. So what's going on is we're delivering 30 SKUs in a kit 100 times a year, but five of the 30 SKUs are the equivalent of $2 clips. So with 43% margin on $2, we don't have enough margin dollars to cover even the cost of, you know, entering the line, on picking it, and so forth. Plus, we did a study on small orders and found out that there were rush orders for just one clip. So imagine, what's the downtime cost? Like, oh, for lack of a clip, I can't finish my job here and move it on to the next guy. In a just-in-time flow factory, one little clip is going to kill you. So the solution was to go out and say, look, we've identified the tiny little items you're buying a zillion times and even have emergency rush orders on, and we're to create a little tackle box, you know, that we'll put these clips in, and we'll top them off 1 to 4 times a year. So now, instead of buying these things 100 times a year and then stocking out of them and having downtime and rush orders and so forth, you're never going to stock out of them. And we're both on both sides of the fence. We're going to cut out hundreds of picks or reorders. I've got to, you know, when you buy something like, oh, I just bought this one little clip, you know, unless you consume it right there in the door, you know, on the freight dock, you've got to, you know, go put it somewhere. So, you know, there is the mere cost of my people go pick stuff, your people got to go put it somewhere before they use it in the next, you know, 2 days or something. So as a result of that, they went right out and did this for all their customers. Their customers thought it was fantastic. There were other accounts where it was a vendor-managed inventory. So literally the salesperson or maybe a replenishment clerk would go on site, and it was their job to take inventory, figure out what needed to be bought, build up the order, run in, and have some purchasing person okay it. Now, up front, the customer said, I want, you know, 12 turns on everything a year, including on paper clips and Q-tips and spices in your rack type, you know, the stupid little miscellaneous things around your household. You don't worry about, you know, 12 turns a year and stocking out of it. And so in those cases, they didn't even have to check with the customer. They said, oh, you know, that's a nice sweeping idea. But, you know, some of these items, we could actually turn them, you know, 14 times if we wanted to. But the truth of the matter is the goofy little items, we're going to raise the reorder points, reorder quantities, reduce the turns to 1, 2, 3, 4 a year, and get rid of a lot of small dollar picks and build average order size. This just says, always ask for more earned business. Back in our earlier webinar, play number two, the CEO went out to this largest customer and, you know, walking through the place and chatting people up and thinking outside the box. Basically, when he got to either the vice president of supply chain, he said, look, you know, this isn't normally what I sell, but you've got a huge bulky packaging storage problem in your place. So ship it to our place and we'll deliver 2 skids at a time, you know, because we're over here every day, you know, type of thing. And we'll free up all the space for your manufacturing because you need it. So he was able to get that. He noticed some processing was going on in the customer's premise that could be done better, faster, cheaper, whatever, outsource it to his facility. And got an invitation to set up an outsourcing business for a plant in another city. Would have been a $10 million business all by itself. But internally, he noticed other stuff, and he asked for the order, and the guy said, for sure. So basically, in addition to these other opportunities, they doubled the volume, and because he tuned up a bunch of things as far as the replenishment process, the average order size went up 20%. So, always ask for more. When you have big losing customers who are friendly, and you put all their MRO needs on this new buying process, then it would seem like, you know, you'd say, well, what else can we do? For example, in the OEM paperclip case we just did, what happened was a just-in-time customer said, wow, this tackle box thing for stupid small stuff, because we had this monolithic idea of 100 turns on everything, is great. Could you come in and, you know, study all of our cells and figure out what kind of kit, you know, we would need for the miscellaneous stuff? And so they went out and did that, and on average they increased their volume 20% with all those customers. And curiously, that big losing vendor, $400,000, where they were losing about 5, 6, 7% on operating profit margin percent on the P&L for that big losing vendor, grew from $400,000 in 1 year to $600,000, and the profit swing went from a loss of 5% operating profit margin to a gain of, you know, plus 6, 7%. So it wasn't, you know, they weren't promoting the vendor's product and promotions and, you know, trying to switch people for rebate dollars, they were coming up with new next level customer value solutions that won a lot more business. And so rebates from all of their vendors went up because of customer centric solutions. So rebates, it turns out, is not the engine that drives your profits. It's the caboose. It's customer centric service value innovation that wins you more share of account, share of niche, builds order size, et cetera, but it also grows volume and your rebates too. Now, to do this, as far as your sales force, you're going to have to do some education repetitively. I mean, 5, 6, 10, 15, 27 repetitions. I mean, some people are quick learners, some people are slow. They can all learn. So we need education. We need, obviously, team support. You know, when you go out and you sell a holistic solution and you got to do a lot of things, you need a team of people to do that. And then you have to sort of rethink your incentives. If you pay salespeople strictly on, you know, the margin dollar level, they don't really care about the cost to serve. They're not paid to look at it. In fact, they didn't even want to rock the boat. You know, the fact that this customer is losing money because of cost to serve issues is not my problem. I'm getting a lot of margin dollars, I get a lot of commission, and I just, you know, don't mess. So you need to step in and say, look, we're going to mess, but whatever you made on this account, we're going to guarantee you. So you have no downside risk. And here's what we're going to do to increase, make you look like a hero and increase the share of spend and so forth. And, you know, then you will, maybe we can give you a different kind of incentive at the customer level. In other words, if we guarantee, you know, give you salary in a sense for this account, then going forward, we may say just on this account, we're going to pay you a percent of the increase, the delta change in the net before compensation. You know, these are details that you can figure out. So these are nice problems to have. But when it comes to, okay, let's use, you know, this new analytical, you know, tool shed to do deep dives in 15 different lenses as to why this customer is losing a lot of money. You know, that takes some repetition because people say, I don't really get it. I don't understand it. These are new vocabulary. You know, can't we just keep doing what we're always doing? So you got to hang in there and do, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 case studies, looking at all the different 15 lenses. Then, you know, let's go walk through the place and look at different apartments and chat people up. I mean, people haven't done that before. So, you know, you got to, you know, do that and, you know, hold their hand and it works out just fine. Then ultimately, you're going to need a VP of supply chain solutions, not a sales manager, but a VP of supply chain solutions to basically go pitch the VP of supply chain buying, you know, their counterpart on, hey, here is the holistic system. Here's the noise, the friction in the system. Here are ways we can figure this out. We'll come in and do all of it because you don't have the extra time, talent, and treasure, money, budget, whatever to do it. But, you know, should we all do it for free? If you're the biggest, most profitable customer we have, we'll probably do it for free. On the other hand, if you're a big loser, it's like, no, we'll come in and do all this. But, you know, here are the terms of how, by giving us more volume, basically, you know, larger average orders, whatever, you can earn out, like you perform, cooperate with us, and then you can get through rebate dollars and such, you can pay for the upfront cost. It's a detail. It's something that can be negotiated. Like all things, it depends on the total context of the account, the relationship, and so forth. And then remember, also, the VP of supply chain has to have the, it's not in the budget, flexibility to say, hey, here's what we can do right there on the spot. If they say, oh, gee, you want this? I'm really a messenger boy. Let me run back and talk to the CEO or whatever, and I'll get back to you in, you know, too many, you know, weeks or whatever. Right there, you need to be able to say, hey, here's what we can do on an account-by-account basis. The rep can trigger it all with the price judo pitch. Next slide, we'll look at that. And remain the good guy in some cases if you need a good cop, bad cop. And then there's something called what I call the 9-step chronological process for selling a system refinement, tuning up job, friction removal, et cetera, that we'll take a look at in you know, webinar number 8, which is the next forthcoming webinar. So let's just take this next slide here. So the rep gets a request for a better price, sharpers, pencils, that the best you can do? Oh, no, of course not. You know, if we can work together to take the friction out of the buying process, you know, and lower cost to serve, then we can share that with a lower price. But we can give you a lot of other benefits too. Do you want my team to come in and do an audit or proposal? And so you do. So the rep role will vary with each account, and that would be true customer centricity. The truth of the matter is to say, here's a rep, they have a geographic territory, and all the people in that territory are stuck with that rep, whether they like that rep or not. And that rep is going to do it all. Well, the rep, you know, fine, reps can do a great job of going to somebody who uses the stuff you sell and saying, here it is, let me show you how to use it, whatever. And not either or, and also, wouldn't it be great if they could go to a buyer in a silo who just gets measured on price savings and take that price request and turn that into a summit meeting with the VP of your VP of supply chain solutions with the VP of supply chain, so they can both look at the overall system and say, yes, it makes sense to reconfigure, tune, change the system a bit to, in a sense, harvest win-win savings. And both the rep and the buyer look like heroes. Now, here's another whale curve, and all I've done is superimposed on it different selling styles. So when it comes to these super losers, that's what the case studies 11A, B, and C have been about, and it's going to take basically a team to do that. Over here, in case number two, where the CEO went and doubled the volume with his number one account, it took a team to follow up and install and maintain and evolve and adapt the higher level replenishment solution ideas that they put in there. Now, there are going to be some customers in this category where they're profitable, and sales guys can still call them in the same old way. I mean, if there's an old-time buyer and he wants to buy in an old-time way, and he gives you enough margin dollars per year and enough margin dollars per invoice on average that it's profitable after the salesman's commission, by all means, just give the customer what they want. Then, of course, we could have along here a sea of little accounts that don't have enough annual margin dollars per year, enough average margin dollars per transaction to support face-to-face selling and a, quote, relationship. So we have to hive those away from the outside sales force. It could be 50% of the accounts that are only 10% of the commissionable income, and we can buy those out from the sales guy, and we can hyper-focus the salespeople on doing a deeper, better job taking big guys to the next level. And so we need a model for that. There is sometimes in some channels, there are accounts that buy big quantities of stuff that are brokered straight from the factory to the end user. And so really the distributor is acting really as almost a credit shield. And in theory, the rep could take that volume and switch it very easily to somebody else. So those can be very independent cowboys where the rep's relationship is a much bigger percent of why the customer buys than, you know, having the right stuff in inventory and picking and packing and getting to the place on time, all the other things that a total fulfillment team would do out of a warehouse. So we're looking at about four different service models that we could create and fine-tune and improve if we had the right analytics. And this basically, and I'll go over it in a future future webinar, but basically these are the chronological process steps that you go through to qualify, cultivate, do an audit, make a pitch to do an audit, do a thorough analysis, make a thorough proposal with upfront asks, install it, measure it, improve it, adapt it, maintain it, expand it, and keep it. Because, you know, sooner or later, a key guy's going to leave and some new guy's going to come in and say, oh, your competition says they're going to do everything you're doing, they'll give me 5% less. So here's last look, you know, meet the price. That's where you have to say, oh, no, this is enormous sweat equity on both parts. There's a lot of switching costs that you don't see. And fortunately, you've measured them all and have all your little fans in-house that are saying, hey, no, we're not switching because these are all the surprise expenses we'd have and so forth. And over here, we need different kinds of skills, which are typically not going to be all wound up in one sales guy with one, you know, who's got X budget, you know, flexibility and so forth. If you go to my old website, Merrifield.com, and look at Exhibit 59, it's even on MerrifieldAct2.com under Exhibits. You'll find sort of a, you know, a document on, you know, what this is all about and how to do it. And then this sort of gives you a bigger picture, sort of a, how do we teach customers to buy and migrate them towards integrated sole supply, continuous evergreen, win-win relationships. We're both moving down the cost curve. So if that happened, our margin percent would drop, but our cost to serve would drop sooner and bigger. So even though our margin percent is lower, our operating profit return on that account is even higher. And, you know, not all customers, some customers just aren't going to learn. I mean, they're going to be stuck here in the little red box. So along this continuum, it's basically, does the customer philosophically, intellectually get win-win, you know, and how much so? And going up this one, do they have the sophistication to believe and use supply chain math to co-create a better way of buying? Now, most sellers and buyers are down here in the bid bark and buy for price reverse auction box. Yeah, I buy from two of you guys. I got to check price. I check price every day, once a week, once a quarter, every 3 years, and in some cases for big contracts. But basically, they're hyper-focused on price, not looking at all the other elements. So the good news is, yes, you get real price savings. The bad news is all the other elements, the hidden costs, the soft costs, whatever the hell you want to call them, they all go up more than the price savings went down. So it's a negative trade-off, but they don't get that because, you know, the only that's instantly visible and measurable is price. So that's what they hyper-focus on, both on the buy and the sell. So in theory, if you had basic service brilliance for a number one target niche, the customer would say, hey, here's last look. And you say, I get last look plus two points more. And, you know, you're going to have to eat that because, you know, that's still the best total economic value for you as far as uptime, productivity, da-da-da. They go, yeah, but psychologically, I'm still bummed. I get paid on lowering price. Okay, let's pivot and figure out how to start moving towards an integrated sole supply thing where we, for out of friction removal, we're allowed to also give you a lower price plus improve all the other elements of the total replenishment process. And up here in 6-6 land is McDonald's. Back in 1956, Ray Kroc was philosophically win-win on a handshake. He said, you know, here's the contract, give me everything, charge me list price. But as you buy in larger volumes, pass those volume savings on to me. And his original distributor he cut a deal with did not do that. He reneged, he lied, and he cheated, and he got caught on it. And Ray said, okay, you know, you're bad, you're forgiven. From now on, it's going to be open book. So distributors today have had contracts with McDonald's for 60-plus years and climbing. But their margins have dropped from 25% with a cost to serve of 20 with an operating profit of 5% down to margins out of the warehouse at 5%, cost to serve 4%. You're only making 1% operating profit, but asset turns, inventory receivables have gone from maybe 12 to like 80. So they're still making an incredible return on a very shrinking, you know, investment in inventory receivables to take care of McDonald's. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons structurally why that works best in an environment like McDonald's, but why and how those you know, McDonald's basically has managed their distributors. It is, we're to turn this around. We're to say, actually, distributors, 1, 2, 3, 4% of your customers, you can go out and proactively pitch the idea of moving along this path. And those 1, 2, 3, 4% customers will be receptive to that. And that's something you can do that Amazon Business cannot do. So, you know, let's figure out what you do best and do it even better with your best accounts. And down here, YouTube playlist number 9, clips 14 through 17 basically go into this thing in great detail. Summary thoughts. Net profit analytics at the line item level enables you, in theory, potentially, to do a McDonald's type 3PL open book, customer-centric, win-win selling, you know, process model, which will work with 1, 2, 3% of your biggest, best, most progressive, most innovative customers. And those are the ones you want to marry because they keep growing and they will grow you. It allows you to deal with cloud e-commerce attacks. So, you know, I go to Amazon, I say, wait a minute, I need a big ticket popular item and I can buy it or its equivalent for a lot less through Amazon Business. Hey, distributor dude, here's last look. You're going, well, I really can't afford to do that because these are my cream items. They pay for all my losing items, all my losing customers, et cetera. So if I cut this, then I'm just, you know, I'm out of business. And besides, I've got a standard one-size-fits-all selling model starring outside salespeople, you know, making regular, you know, routine calls on millennials who don't want to see them. So, you know, well, wait a minute, to come up with a new business model at the customer level, you know, a new e-selling model, we have to unweave and reweave our service cost bundle, and we have to tune it, unweave and reweave it to the customer's liking and co-creative energy and effort. And this really matters just for the top 5-10% of the customers that matter. Remember, if you go back to the original slide where 16% of the customers were generating 88% of the margin dollars. You know, that's where the biggest friction removal opportunity is, the biggest upside partnership opportunities are, and so forth. So we need to have that kind of flexibility. Digital disruptors can't do the 9-step system replenishment selling. Neither can or will 90% or more of all distributors out there. You know, when a new paradigm comes along, most people don't see it, they don't believe it, they just want to keep doing what they're doing, and they just quietly fold up and disappear. So the game isn't necessarily so much against Amazon Business as it is to win against all the lagging legacy distributor competitors that you may have. So anyway, that's enough. And what I'll do is in the next webinar 8, I'll talk a little bit more about how we move to new e-selling models and incentives. You know, the third rail in American politics, the third rail is don't ever suggest you're going to cut Social Security and Medicare greedy geezer benefits. We need to. Demographics, we're broke. And we need to, you know, switch, we need to move the age up for Social Security. We need to, you know, tax the hell out of it, make it sort of needs-based and so forth. But that's not good. All the old people vote. So, you know, when it comes to all the stuff, it's like, oh, no, we're not going to mess with the sales force and how we pay them and so forth. And yet you have to. And, you know, you have to, and by doing so, you'll expand the pie for everybody, including the sales reps. But again, the solution is, you know, education. So tune in for webinar number 8. Thanks very much.